So what's the main difference? The main difference in separating a small bowel infarct versus a bloody diarrhea related to an ischemic ulcer in the splenic flexure? The main difference is the presentation. They both can have bloody diarrhea, that's true. But the pain, but the small bowel infarction will be diffuse abdominal pain. Diffuse. All over it hurts, not one specific area. Whereas in ischemic colitis, and they'll point right over here. Okay? So that distinguishes whether it's a small bowel infarct versus a small infarct in the colon. They can pinpoint right to that area. Now the other vascular lesions, the exact picture was on boards. I know that because one of my students took the test. And so they had a picture, Dr. Goyon, of said cecum, and it looked like these cystic spaces in it, and I didn't know what it was. I almost wrung their neck, because that's angiodysplasia. Now, angiodysplasia is the second most common cause of hematochezia, diverticulosis being one. It's very, very, very common. And the reason why it's in the cecum, guys, is the law of Laplace again, about wall stress. Remember, the diameter of the colon is bigger, the cecum is bigger than any other part of the colon. Agreed? And so because the diameter is greater, then the wall stress is greater. Agreed? And so you're putting stress on the vessels that are in the wall of the cecum, and it actually pulls them apart a little bit, forming these telangiectasia. It kind of stretches them out a little bit and predisposes to this because of the increase in wall tension. And if you're unfortunate enough that one of them ruptures to the surface, you can end up with significant bleed. That's a very, very common cause of hematochezia in older people. So diverticulosis is the first thing you'd rule out, and if that's been ruled out, then it's angiodysplasia. Part two deals with relationship of angiodysplasia with aortic stenosis and relationship of angiodysplasia with von Willebrand's disease. Part one doesn't. All they want you to know is what it is and how to identify it, and that's it. All right, Meckel's diverticulum, 2 feet, 2 inches, 2% of the population from the terminal ileum, okay? Remember, the most common complication of the Meckel's diverticulum is bleeding. But also, because it is a diverticulum, it can get inflamed, and so it can get a diverticulitis. And there was a student in the room here whose friend recently took the test, and apparently there was a question where the patient had a hematemesis, and melena, and pain, kind of in the right lower quadrant area. Okay, and they had down ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, Meckel's diverticulum, and I forgot what the other choices were. The only one that would fit, hematemesis and melena, Crohn's disease wouldn't fit that because you wouldn't have hematemesis from that. It would have to be Meckel's diverticulitis with bleeding. And that was the answer to that particular question. Because of the bleeding and the vomiting, some of that fluid from the neck can get up there, get acid involvement of it, and it'll become melena. You'll have the bleeding aspect of it, and that's the right location for Meckel's diverticulum because reasonably close, it means 2 feet from the ileocecal valve. So I think that was the best answer. Certainly would not fit ulcerative colitis, definitely would not fit Crohn's disease, so it had to be that. All right, here's a... another Meckel's diverticulum. Now, there was an embryology question, guys. It was a newborn that had a sinus, and the umbilicus was draining poo. It was draining feces, and they asked what it was, and the answer was persistent vitelline duct. Remember, Meckel's diverticulum is persistence of the ampulomesenteric, another name, vitelline duct. That's basically what it is. Sometimes it remains open all the way through, so there's a communication between your small bowel and the umbilicus, and that's what they were after. So they have this feces coming out of the umbilicus. That's a persistence of the vitelline duct. Who can tell me if you have urine coming out through the umbilicus? What's that? Persistence of the urethra. So both of them are feces, vitelline duct, urine, urethra. Okay. I like the diagram here because the diagram speaks a lot. The most common location, listen to this carefully, it's an integration I've made and it'll really help you. The most common location for cancer in the entire GI tract is the sigmoid colon. Most common location for polyps in the entire GI tract is the sigmoid colon. Most common location for diverticuli is sigmoid colon. So sigmoid colon is big time for a lot of most common things there. And we're talking the entire GI tract, polyps, cancer, and diverticuli, sigmoid colon. So what's the area of weakness? Well, the area of weakness is where the blood vessels penetrate the bowel. That's not cool, because that means that that's the area of weakness, and what happens is mucosa and submucosa is going to herniate right next to that vessel. And so you can see, there's the vessel right there, there's the diverticular sac, that's a very, very bad next door neighbor. And so you can clearly see that when feces gets stuck in there, and it does, that's called a fecalit, and you could erode that little area right there, you would erode that vessel, you can see then why diverticulosis is the most common cause of hematochezia, massive lower GI bleed. You can see it clearly. Okay, so there you go. And this is a barium study showing it. Now, you know, a lot of students, if they were showed there, they were shown this thing, would say familial polyposis. And, you know, it's an easy mistake to make because it looks like a pile of polyps, except, guys, polyps go into the lumen, not out. Okay, these are extending outside of the lumen. They're not extending inside. So this is not familial polyposis. This is diverticulosis. I'll be honest with you. The first time I saw this, I said it was familial polyposis. Okay? And then I started thinking. I said, that's not it. Well, not that I started thinking. They said it was diverticulosis. And I said, why isn't the familial polyposis? And it dawned on me that these are going out, not in. Okay? So it's diverticulosis when you see it going out. Okay? This is not familial polyposis. Okay. Now, diverticulosis, let's finish with it, has lots of complications as you would expect. Its most common complication is diverticulitis. And I love Sathiston's textbook of surgery description of diverticulitis. It's left-sided appendicitis. So you all know the findings in an appendicitis, right lower quadrant pain, in between right here, McBurney's point, rebound tendonitis, fever, neutrophilic leukocytosis, the whole bit. Agreed? You take that same thing and just move it right over to the left lower quadrant. Okay, in an older person, that's diverticulitis. So it's just like acute appendicitis, except it's on the left side. So they use the term left-sided appendicitis diverticulitis. Okay, so that's the most common. Also, it's the most common cause of fistulous communications in the entire GI tract. Remember, fistula is a communication between two hollow organs. The most common fistula is a colovesical fistula. That was on boards. That's a fistula between the colon and the bladder. And so you get pneumaturia. That's a new one, huh? Hematuria, yeah, blood. Pneumaturia is what? Air. There you are, minding your own business. You're peeing, and air comes out. Whoa! That means you have a colovesical fistula. Most common cause? Diverticular disease. Okay. They can rupture. Okay? And rupture and produce peritonitis. So they have lots of very interesting complications. Diverticular disease, diverticulosis. Inflammatory bowel disease, okay? Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. Crohn's involves the terminal ileum 80% of the time. Sometimes it just involves the terminal ileum. Sometimes it involves the terminal ileum and the colon. And sometimes it just involves the colon. But 80% of the time, the terminal ileum will be involved. Crohn's likes the anus, ulcerative colitis likes the rectum. So they have a preference for which part of the lower part they like. Crohn's likes to produce fistulas and fissures of the anus. Ulcerative colitis likes the rectum, producing bloody diarrhea. Okay. Crohn's jumps around, is transmural, has non-caseating granulomas. Ulcerative colitis doesn't jump around. It stays in continuity and involves the mucosa and submucosa. Now, guys, the diagnosis of Crohn's disease on a board exam is so incredibly simple, okay, because look at this, please. I put this in the way it looks like in the body. This is the ileocecal valve. This is the ascending colon. That's the terminal ileum. And clearly you can see that there's a transmural inflammation here. Look at the lumen here. I'm brought in the lumen here. Now watch. Look. Ooh, I'd say that's pretty narrow. So what do you think the pain's going to be like in Crohn's disease, guys? It's going to be colicky, right lower quadrant pain with diarrhea in a young person. There aren't too many things that do that, guys. There aren't too many things that produce a colicky pain in the right lower quadrant in a young person. In fact, hardly any. It's Crohn's. Now, if it's in a third world country, what is it? TB, you got it. And it's not, and it's Mycobacterium bovis, not MTB. In this country, if we were to get intestinal TB, it's Mycobacterium tuberculosis from swallowing it from a primary in the lung. In third world countries that don't have pasteurization, Mycobacterium bovis is the most common cause. But that would produce the findings that look like Crohn's disease in third world countries. That's tuberculosis. That's because that's where Peyer's patches are. Okay, this is the string sign. When you do a barium study, you can see that this would look like a string, wouldn't it, with the barium. In fact, I think I got a picture of that. So you can see it's transmural, and you can see that it's segmental. Look how dilated the proximal bowel is. Holy mackerel. It's having to push stool through that. Can't. That is the fissuring that we see very commonly, what they call cobblestoning. These look like cobblestones. And look at all the ulceration that one sees in here in Crohn's disease. Okay, look at these linear ulcers. Sometimes use the term serpiginous, like a serpent. That looks like a boa constrictor there. Look at all these fissures in between, which are called aphthous ulcers. There we go. Look at this. Look at that narrowing again there that we see in that section. And then here is a non-caseating granuloma. Now, those are a little bit harder to identify. They don't look nice and round, but I think you can see that there's some multinucleated giant cells in there. That's a non-caseating granuloma, very characteristic of Crohn's. Okay. And here's your string sign right there. This is the cecum over here, and you can see that there's even some involvement with that also. Okay, ulcerative colitis always begins in the rectum, always. Okay, and it can stay there, or it can just move up in continuity and involve the whole colon, but it never involves the terminal ileum. So it's not good to involve the whole colon. It's called pancolitis. That's the one that has the highest incidence of developing cancer. Okay, so the more involvement you have, the longer the duration, the greater the chance for cancer related to ulcerative colitis. Now look at this, please. Okay, you see this red stuff here, right over there? Those are called pseudopolyps. You see all this stuff in between here? That's all ulcerated mucosa and submucosa. And so really what this is, what pseudopolyps are residual mucosa that's inflamed. And those are what they call pseudopolyps. They kind of look like polyps, but they're basically inflamed, bloody mucosa. All this gray stuff that you see in between is totally ulcerated off. And you're basically looking at the submucosa of the colon here. Okay. Here's another example of it over here. You can see that's in continuity, see? And then this particular case just stopped right there. Ulcerative colitis has the highest association with cancer, HLA-B27 positive ankylosing spondylitis, and a very, very common, not common, but it's the most common cause of sclerosing pericholangitis, where you get sclerosis, fibrosis around the common bile duct, producing obstructive jaundice, and a high incidence of cholangiocarcinoma. That's ulcerative colitis too. Okay. I got a great chart that down there between the two, so make sure that you know all the differences between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. And they're pretty easy. Let's talk about polyps. This is a nice little display of polyps here. Have you seen that before? There you go. That was about 250 slides ago. Do you see this? No. Okay, the most common polyp in the entire GI tract is a hyperplastic polyp. It's just a little nubbin sitting on top over here. That's a hyperplastic. We probably all have those. Those are hamartomas. There's no polyposis syndrome with these. There's no neoplasm. And, of course, they're more commonly located in the sigmoid colon. Now, this, we already told you, was a tubular adenoma. And it looks like a strawberry on a stick. So it's got a stalk. This is the histologic section of that. You can see there's the stalk, and there's the strawberry. Okay, so stalk, strawberry, tubular adenoma, precursor lesion for colon cancer. Okay, look at this. Ooh, there's a polyp coming out of a poor little dude's butt. Okay, that's not stool, that's a polyp. In fact, here's the polyp right over here. This is a juvenile polyp. It's a kid. They got a polyp. It's a juvenile polyp. They're in the rectum. All juvenile polyps are located in the rectum. They're hamartomas. They have no precancerous ability at all. Okay. Now, while I'm looking at this, let's make believe this was an adult, and this thing was sticking out of the butt like this. What would that be? Because that's what they asked on an exam. They talked about an adult that had this reddish mass coming out of their butt. What would it be? Internal hemorrhoid was the answer. Remember this always, please. Internal hemorrhoids bleed, external hemorrhoids thrombose. So when you have blood-coating stool, that's not from an external hemorrhoid, that's from an internal hemorrhoid. And I might also add, internal hemorrhoids are not painful, but they do prolapse. It took me a while to figure that one out. I was thinking initially it was a... I was thinking all kinds of things, and it dawned on me. Idiot! I have that. Okay? I have grade 3 prolapse of an internal hemorrhoid, and that's what they were talking about. Okay, that's what was prolapsing out of the dude's butt, was internal hemorrhoid. Okay, and then you can push him back in many times. Sometimes they don't. That's stage 4, and you got to get him removed. So that's a common board question, part 1. Adult with something reddish sticking out of their butt, prolapsed internal hemorrhoid. Internal hemorrhoids bleed, external hemorrhoids thrombose, and they're painful. All right, here's the bad guy polyp. This is called a sessile couch potato polyp. And it's very unusual because if you look at it, it looks like the villous surface of the small intestine. Hence the name villous adenoma. Because they have these little finger-like excrescences that look like small intestine. And this is how they kind of look like histologically. Now these are the most, have the greatest malignant potential of all polyps. And they're usually in a rectal sigmoid. And because of the fact that they are villus-like, finger-like, and there's lots of mucus, they often have a lot of mucus coating the stool. My mom had that, actually. I remember her distinctly many, many years ago saying, you know, Edu. Okay, I said, Edu. That's Eddie in Polish. I'm 50% Polish, 50% Armenian. That's why I pronounce it Golyan. Okay, that's the Armenian pronunciation. It's not Goljansky. Okay, it's Golyan. There are, it could go either way. There's Golyans, there's Goljans in Poland, and there's Golyans, which are Armenians in Poland. So that's how we found out. My grandmother came from Armenia, okay, and then they were in southern Poland. And so my grandmother was pure Armenian. My mother's family is from Poland. And so I'm 50-50. I like the name Golyan. That's why I use that rather than Goljan. I didn't like that so much. My brother still's Goljan. My sister still, well, she's married. But I just like the term Golyan. It just has a nice ring to it, even though everybody mispronounces it. Okay, so this is villous adenoma. It's got a 50% chance of being malignant when you see him. My mom was lucky. It was totally benign. So this is the one that secretes lots of mucus and it coats your stool. And that's what happened with her. Says, when I go to the bathroom and I got the stool and there's all this mucus on it. I says, oh, that's going to send you to a surgeon. He did just a simple proctoscope and there it was. It was a villous adenoma. So tubular adenomas are precursors for cancer. And size pretty much determines their malignant potential. If they're over 2 centimeters, they're very dangerous. And then villous adenomas are very, very dangerous. This is familial polyposis. I showed you two of them. These are both of the ones that are available in pathology slide sets. I kind of like this one because it's got a lot of polyps there. This one's a little tougher, but there's polyps all over the place. You have to have more than 100 polyps to call it familial. Don't count because, you know, if you started counting these things over here, the exam would be over. And if you have attention deficit, you probably get to here, forget, get distracted, and then you'd have to start all over again. So that would not be good. Now, remember, this is autosomal dominant familial polyposis, the APC suppressor gene, plus a couple other dudes. RAS oncogenes involved in this, P53 is involved in this, but the APC is the big one. Remember that you will always get cancer in them, okay, usually between 35 and 40, so they prophylactically have to remove your bowel. Now, also remember that autosomal dominant diseases are famous for late manifestations, concept of penetrance, and a variable expressivity. In other words, do patients with familial polyposis have polyps at birth? No. They start developing when they are in between 10 and 20 years of age. an adult polycystic kidney disease, you have cysts at birth. No, you start developing between 10 and 20 years of age. Huntington's chorea, you start having chorea at birth. No, you start developing 35, 40 years of age. So they have late manifestations with autosomal dominant. And that's a famous question also on boards. Now, if you had this colon and you had brain tumors, that's called Turcot syndrome. The way I remember that, turbid, Turcot, pretty close. Okay, and so that's the one with the brain tumors. So you have familial polyps, you have a polyposis syndrome plus brain tumors, Turcot syndrome. And it's autosomal recessive, not dominant. Okay, you have this kind of a lesion in there, multiple polyps in there, plus benign soft tissue tumors, desmoids, osteomas in the jaw, Gardner syndrome. All memorization. Okay, that's all I can tell you on that. I think that's enough for polyposis syndromes. Carcinoid tumors. Okay, I like this because it has a whole... Have you seen this before? You did, because I put it along with a couple other things under the output tumors. I had melanoma there and other ones. Yeah, I had these two initially. Now listen very carefully to this because you can really miss something simple. All carcinoid tumors are malignant, but they have low-grade potential. And a lot of it depends on their size, on whether they're going to metastasize. And the magic number, again, is 2. If they're greater than 2 centimeters, they have the ability to metastasize. Now, listen carefully. The most common location for a carcinoid tumor is the tip of the appendix. And that's what this is. And they have a very bright yellow color. Okay? Very bright yellow. It's just impossible to miss these things. But they are never the cause of carcinoid syndrome. Why? Because you can see if it's the tip of the appendix, they're not going to usually be greater than 2 centimeters. So where is the most common location of a carcinoid tumor that can be associated with carcinoid syndrome? Terminal ileum is the answer. Terminal ileum is the answer. They're always greater than 2 centimeters. Now, what do all carcinoid tumors make? Serotonin. And since the appendix and the terminal ileum are drained by the portal vein, that serotonin that they make goes to the portal vein, goes to the hepatocyte, it's metabolized into 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid, and you pee it out. So you don't have it in your bloodstream. So you have no signs of flushing or diarrhea because it has no contact with your systemic circulation. But if you metastasize to the liver, then those metastatic nodules that are making serotonin can dump some of it into the hepatic vein tributaries. Does that have access to your circulation? Sure, it's going to go into the anterior vena cava, and then it's going to the right side of your heart, and that's why you get those right-sided lesions, tips, tricuspid insufficiency, pulmonic stenosis. Remember? Now, serotonin's a vasodilator in some cases. It's a vasoconstrictor in other cases. But in terms of carcinoid syndrome, it's a dilator that produces the flushing, which is the most common symptom of carcinoid, followed by diarrhea. It's unfortunate it's that order, because usually you have diarrhea and then you flush. Is that correct? You knew I had to do something in here, didn't you? Yeah, I mean, you don't flush and then have diarrhea, flush and then have diarrhea. You have diarrhea, then you flush. So unfortunately, you're going to have to think in reverse. Flushing is the most common symptom. Diarrhea is the second most common one. And so, of course, if it has access to your systemic circulation, you even have way higher levels of 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid, and that's a screening test of choice, because that's the metabolite of serotonin. Now, having said all that, you're losing a lot of serotonin or making a lot of serotonin. What amino acid could be deficient, please? Tryptophan. If tryptophan's deficient, please, what vitamin would be deficient? Niacin. Therefore, could you have pellagra if you had carcinoid syndrome? Yes, and it was on the boards. Yes, you can. Because you're using up all your tryptophan making serotonin instead of niacin. Aren't they clever on boards? You can just see them all sitting around. They're just laughing and having a good old time and just thinking about ways of screwing you. But unfortunately, we're screwing that because we've got them all figured out. At least I do. Now you do. These are neurosecretory granules on an electron micrograph. That's what these little black dots are. But you wouldn't know that unless they gave you history. Colon cancer. I put all the good ones up here. There's no such thing as good ones. I just put up, that's a terrible thing to say with cancer. But I put all the ones, the common ones that are available in the slides that's up here for you. Okay, remember, left side obstructs, right side bleeds in terms of colon cancer. And that's easy to understand. Your left colon has a smaller diameter than your right. And so when the cancer develops in your left colon and it decides, do I want to go out and form a polyp? It goes out and says there's not enough room, so it goes around. So it's annular, napkin ring. And of course, that's going to produce constriction. You can see that. Look at this. This is the bowel open in the left colon. That's one edge of the bowel over here, one edge of the bowel over here. This is the cancer. Notice, that's one edge, that's one edge. Can you see that that's constricted? So you would have signs of obstruction there, wouldn't you? Left side obstructs, right side bleeds. In the right colon, this is right colon, because there's a bigger diameter, it has a greater chance of going out and forming a polyp. There it is. And so therefore, it's sitting out in the stool. It will bleed. So right side bleeds, left side obstructs. So which one's more likely to have iron deficiency? Right-sided lesion. There you go. Which one's more likely to have alteration in bowel habits? No constipation, diarrhea. Left-sided. And they put that in the stems, guys. Put that in the stems of the question. Here's another. Look at that one. You know that's left-sided. Look at that obstruction. Wow. Now you know that the tumor marker CEA, carcinoembryonic antigen. It's not used to diagnose colon cancer. It's used to follow it for recurrence. Most common cause of this thing relates a lot to diet, okay? lack of fiber in stool. Remember, the more fiber you have in stool, the less chance of colon cancer because you're getting rid of lithocholic acid. Okay, so that's a big one. Age is also one. Just over 50 is a risk factor for this. Smoking has an association with colon cancer. Okay, of course, polyposis syndromes also do, like familial polyposis, Gardner syndrome, Tourette syndrome, not Peutz Jeghers, not hyperplastic polyps, not juvenile polyps. So polyps and all those other things also, risk factors. I put the two best pictures of appendicitis up there for you. So it'll be one or the other of these if they were to throw this at you. You can see this is a vermiform thing. You can see it's covered by pus. I like this one because it shows the most common cause of appendicitis in adults. That's a fecal lip. Okay, that's a impacted stool. Okay, and what happens is if you impact stool in there, that's going to press on the sides of the appendix, produce ischemia, and then you get a little breakdown of the mucosa. E. coli gets in there, acute appendicitis. Listen carefully. That's the same or a same mechanism for diverticulitis. Remember, those little diverticular sacs also get fecalits in them, and the same exact thing happens. So the pathogenesis of acute diverticulitis and acute appendicitis is exactly the same. Fecalith, ischemia along the wall, inflammation, E. coli. Can I make another analogy? So it's acute cholecystitis, except it's not a fecalith, it's a stone in a cystic duct that's entrapped there, pushes a little bit on the side, ischemia, acute cholecystitis, E. coli. So there's a concept there. Okay, so we have acute cholecystitis, we have diverticulitis, and acute appendicitis, all related to something obstructing a lumen, causing mucosal damage, E. coli, inflammation. Except acute cholecystitis is a stone, appendicitis, diverticulitis, it's a fecalith. Now, it's not the most common cause in children. In children, it's measles and or an adenovirus infection. And then what happens is you get acute appendicitis. Why? Because there's lymphoid tissue in the appendix. Okay? And what happens is when you get an adenovirus and measles, you get hyperplasia of the lymphoid tissue in the appendix. And so it kind of can obstruct the lumen and set up a nidus for mucosal injury, and then you end up with acute appendicitis. So it usually follows a viral infection, as opposed to adults, which is usually a fecal lip in the circle of Willis. Okay. We're done with GI. Starting liver. I think you would agree there's nothing all that hard on GI. A lot of nice pictures and stuff like that, but nothing too terribly, things that you haven't heard before, maybe a couple things. So I don't think you have too much problem with it. Let me tell you what your problem, if any, will be with liver. And that's going to be bilirubin of all things. Bilirubin will be your problem. Okay? So we'll make sure that you got jaundice down pretty good. The rest of it's pretty much bird feed in terms of difficult concepts, not very hard. A little late. I wish I had this at exactly 8 this morning. It would have been a lot better. All right. So let's talk about bilirubin metabolism. Well, you know half the story already. You know that most of the bilirubin that we have in our blood, in fact, almost all of it, is unconjugated bilirubin. And what did it derive from? The red blood cells, when they got old and they got phagocytosed and they got destroyed, unconjugated bilirubin was the end product. It went out into the bloodstream, bound with albumin, went to the liver, and it's taken up. So when we get bilirubins on us in here, I don't see anyone that looks jaundiced to me right now. Okay? The majority, 99% of the bilirubin, which is about 1 milligram per deciliter, is the bilirubin that came from the breakdown of our old red blood cells. So it's all unconjugated, and that's why we don't have any in our urine, because it's lipid-soluble. Agreed? Okay, let's take the story up from there. So it gets taken up by the liver, it gets conjugated. Remember, any time the cytochrome P450 system in the liver conjugates or deals with any drug or any metabolite, it renders it water-soluble. So we had a lipid-soluble unconjugated bilirubin. It's going to be converted into a conjugated bilirubin, which is known as direct bilirubin. It's water-soluble. All drugs. See, one of the purposes of the liver in metabolizing drugs is to render lipid-soluble drugs water-soluble so you can pee them out. So it always makes something lipid-soluble water-soluble. So we have, we conjugate it, and we have water-soluble bilirubin. But listen very carefully. Once bilirubin is taken up by the liver, it never has, it's not even close to a vessel. There is no way it can get in a vascular channel once it gets taken up by the liver. So if direct conjugated bilirubin in our urines because something happened either in the liver or in the bile ducts to have caused it to get there because it shouldn't have access to our bloodstream. So it's taken up in the liver, it's conjugated, it's pumped into the bile ductules, which go into the portal, into the triads, eventually gets stored, it comes down the common bile duct, some of it's stored in the gallbladder, and it goes into our small intestine through the common bile duct. So bile contains conjugated bilirubin. It also contains bile salts, cholesterol, estrogen, and a few other things in it too. But it has conjugated bilirubin in it that we're going to get rid of. And so it takes a long trip, this conjugated bilirubin, down to the colon. And the bacteria have been waiting for the conjugated bilirubin, and they will break it down back into unconjugated bilirubin. Isn't that interesting? And then it continues to break it down, and here's where one of the big problems is. It's how you were taught and what name they gave this compound. In the old days, and it is the old days, it was called stercobilinogen. When the colon bacteria continued to break down the unconjugated thing and broke it down into stercobilinogen. And you were taught that stercobilinogen, when it's oxidized into stercobilin, produces the color of stool. Okay? That term is no longer used anymore. We use the term urobilinogen now for that pigment to make it easier for you to understand this concept that we're going to be teaching you. So it's urobilinogen, not stercobilinogen. Forget stercobilinogen. Throw it out the window. It's confused you these years. And so it breaks it down into the unconjugated bilirubin into urobilinogen. All porphyrins are colorless when they're in an ogen compound, but when you oxidize them, then they have color. So urobilinogen, when it gets oxidized in the colon, becomes urobilin. That's the color of stool. Right there. You with me so far? A small portion of urobilinogen is reabsorbed out of the colon. Most of it goes back to the liver. A little bit of it goes into the kidney and ends up in your urine, where it gets oxidized into urobilin, and guess what? That's the cause for the color of urine. So the same pigment that colors stool is the same pigment that colors urine. See, you were taught stercobilinogen in the colon, urobilinogen responsible for color in the urine, when they're the same pigment. They corrected naming it sterco because that means feces, but every student thought they were different pigments. They're not. They're exactly the same. So now we don't use the term stercobilinogen. It's too confusing. Got it? If you do, then you understand then that if you obstructed bile flow, whether in the liver or whether in a common bile duct, what should the color of your stool be? Light colored, because it wouldn't have had access to bilirubin to your stool to make urobilinogen. And of course, would you have any urobilinogen in your urine? No. No. You understand? Good. Now you'll understand jaundice. Okay. Hepatologists, when they think about jaundice, they do a little calculation. And what they do is they take the total bilirubin, okay, and they find out what the percentage of that total bilirubin is conjugated bilirubin or direct bilirubin. That's the way that most of them do it. It's not hard. Let's say the total's 10, and let's say conjugated bilirubin's 5. The percent conjugated bilirubin's 50%. Do you understand how that's done? Okay? And so they subdivide jaundice into three types. Conjugated bilirubin percent less than 20%. So what is that essentially saying if it's less than 20% of the total? Most of it is unconjugated. So in a sense, that's predominantly unconjugated. Then they have it between 20 and 50%. So what does that mean? If the percentage is 20 to 50%, that means some of it's conjugated and some of the increase is unconjugated. Okay? And then greater than 50% is conjugated bilirubin. What does that mean? Okay, that means that most of it's conjugated bilirubin. Okay? You know what it also means? You have obstruction. So here's what it turns out. If it's less than 20% conjugated bilirubin, you're talking about primarily unconjugated hyperbilirubinemias, guys. Now I want you to think about things that could increase unconjugated bilirubin. Okay? Well, first of all, we already know a whole pile of them already because we talked about hemolytic anemias already, and we know that that's an unconjugated bilirubin type. Spherocytosis, right? Sickle cell anemia, right? And we also know even ABO, hemolytic disease of the newborn, RH, hemolytic disease of the newborn, physiologic jaundice of the newborn, because they can't conjugate it, okay? So we know that we can get unconjugated bilirubin increase because we're breaking down more red blood cells. We know we can get it because there's some problems with the conjugating enzymes. They're either too immature or they're missing. Krigler-Nadjer syndrome. So either we're making too much because we're breaking too many RBCs down, or we have a problem with the conjugating enzymes. That would be like little babies with physiologic jaundice of the newborn, also breast milk jaundice, okay? Or rare diseases where we're deficient in the enzyme called Krigler-Nadjer, okay? The ones between 20 and 50%, guys, are hepatitis. Hepatitis is an inflammation of your liver, not just part of it, all of it. And so because it's a sick liver, it doesn't want to take up the unconjugated. Do you have parties when you're sick and have everyone come in your house? Or do you say, get away, go back home, or just wait outside the door until I'm feeling better? And so unconjugated bilirubin's building up behind the liver and says, you know, Joe is sick. We can't go in and get conjugated, so we're going to have to wait a while. So they increase in the blood. And plus the fact you have inflammation in the liver, and so that's going to destroy the architecture in the liver and maybe break open a couple of the small bile ducts in there that have what in them? Conjugated bilirubin. Now, because you've disrupted the architecture in there is a possibility of water-soluble bilirubin to get in the bloodstream because you have necrosis of liver cells and bile ducts, and so you're going to get some conjugated bilirubin in your bloodstream too. So it'll turn out to be somewhere between 20 and 50%. That's all the hepatitis is, including alcoholic. If it's greater than 50%, that is an absolute no-brainer. That it's clearly an obstruction of bile. And we have intrahepatic obstruction. That's called intrahepatic cholestasis. That means what? That means that you are blocking bile flow in the liver. What are we talking about? Little bile ducts, triads. That's what we're talking about. Then we have extrahepatic. What's extra mean? Outside of what? Liver cholestasis. Well, there's only one thing outside the liver. That's the stinking common bile duct, guys. So that means something's obstructing that. And just play odds for me, please. A stone in the gallbladder and in the common bile duct. And where did it come from? It came from the gallbladder. That has to be the most common cause. And then we also have that carcinoma of the head of the pancreas, because you learned in anatomy that there's ducts of Wirsung and other things that go through the head of the pancreas. And so if you have the carcinoma of the head of the pancreas, you have complete bile duct obstruction. So we have intrahepatic cholestasis, we have extrahepatic cholestasis, right? And so what's going to happen? It's like water behind the dam, guys. Okay, if you block bile flow, then it backs up where? Backs right up from where it was made, into the liver cells. And what is it doing there? It eventually bubbles outside of it, and now it has access to the sinusoids, and it's in your bloodstream now. So the predominant fraction in your bloodstream is conjugated. Conjugated bilirubin, okay? Which, of course, is water-soluble. And so you're going to have really dark yellow urine. And what's your stool going to look like? It's going to be light-colored. I mean, that combination, guys, goodness gracious. You know, mainly conjugated bilirubin fraction, bilirubin in your urine, which you know has to be conjugated, and light-colored stools, come on! That can only be obstruction. Nothing else can do that. Nothing. So it's either intrahepatic or extrahepatic that's causing that. And they give you all this information on the boards. Really, really, really not hard. Let's deal with a couple little weirdo things. Okay, let's see where we are here. Lisa, see something here. Yeah, let me just deal with a couple weirdo causes of jaundice. Not weirdo, actually. One is the second most common cause. And then we can dispense totally with jaundice on this thing. Don't worry about where I am. It's all there, guys. Don't worry about where I am. You'll come across it. You'll have questions on it. No problem. I'm jumping ahead just a ticky here to just finish this concept right here because of the time element. Okay, we already went through some of the most common causes of these different types of jaundice. I want to throw in just a couple others, and so we can dispense with it entirely at this point. And that's this disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome, of which many of you right in this room have it. Okay, and most of you don't know you have it because you maybe haven't fasted for more than 24 hours. If you have, then you would have noticed that you'd have jaundice, and that it seems to relate to not eating. That's what our Guillain-Barré syndrome is. Autosomal dominant. It's absolutely benign thing. You don't do liver biopsy. And here's the problem. It's a problem in taking up bilirubin, and it's a little bit of a problem in conjugating bilirubin. That's it. And so it's predominantly an unconjugated type of hyperbilirubinemia. Sheila Sherlock was the one that made up the fasting test for Guillain-Barré's disease. If you want to sound smart, you said Guillain-Barré's. If you want to sound just common, Gilbert's. I mean, if you had a salon, guys, if we were going to go to a salon to have our hair cut, would we go to Gilbert's salon where all your hair would be cut off? Okay, are we going to go to Guillain-Barré's salon? That one, because we know we're going to get styled, okay? All right, you're going to go to Consuela's salon, or you're going to go to Joe's salon to get your hair cut? Consuela, okay? You're going to go there. Okay, so you want to sound smart, say Guillain-Barré. It sounds a lot better than Gilbert's. Oh, that's all I have? Yeah. But you have Guillain-Barré's. Oh, I do? Is it bad? No, it's nothing. Oh, I like that. Okay. And it's interesting. People actually do that. It sounds nice. Guillain-Barré, something to talk about, you know. Whatever. Sheila Sherlock found out that the best test is the fasting. And it'll come. So you get a baseline bilirubin. Total bilirubin, when they're not jaundiced. They say, I want you to not eat for 24 hours and come back. Okay, so they don't eat for 24 hours, they come back, you see they're already jaundiced. You get the blood, and here's the thing. If you have your baseline's 1, let's say, and you double the baseline, bilirubin after 24 hours. You have Gilbert's. So in other words, if you come back, it's 2.5. It was 1, it's 2.5 now. Okay? You have Gilbert syndrome. It's called a fasting test. Extremely common. Second most common cause of jaundice in the United States. Most common one being hepatitis A. That's number one cause. Number two is Gilbert's. When you'll notice it is in residencies. Yes, I said residencies. All of you here. Residencies. I'm speaking it into existence. Residencies. When you're on duty and you don't get a chance to eat, okay, that's when your Gilbert's will show up. You start seeing yellow in your eyes, and of course you say, oh my God, I got hepatitis B. But I didn't get a needle stick. It's Gilbert's. Then you go and get some studies, and you find out that all your enzyme studies are totally normal, and that it's mainly unconjugated bilirubin, and then you remember Goyon screaming and yelling about Gilbert syndrome. He said, that's what I got. Okay, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. If you like the yellow look, good. As a matter of fact, you can get green eyes with that. How are you going to do that? Get a contact lens that is blue. Yellow plus blue equals green. And you can end up with green eyes if you want. So why don't you take advantage of the thing? You could do that. You could do that. Because blue and yellow equals green. Cool. Man, look at those green eyes. Yeah. Yeah. So you may like the jaundice look. Who knows? Who knows? People are weird. No, you're weird, Dr. Goyon. Forget the people. You're the weird one. Okay. The other one that we want to mention, we mentioned Crigler-Najjar. You know, I don't think they're going to waste a question, one of 350 questions on Crigler-Najjar, which you're never going to see. Another one that you want to know maybe is Dubin-Johnson-Roeder syndrome. Those are genetic diseases that involve the ability to get rid of conjugated bilirubin in the bile ducts. And so that's predominantly a conjugated type of hyperbilirubinemia. And in Dubin-Johnson, they have this strange pigment that's a black-colored pigment that builds up in the liver, and you get black livers. They're really nothing diseases, and I sincerely doubt, with only 350 questions, you're going to waste one. They're going to waste one on Crigler-Najjar, Roeder, and Dubin-Johnson when they're so incredibly unreal. Gilbert's, that's another story. Second most common cause of jaundice in the United States. That they'll do. Okay, 11 minutes. 12, according to this, because mine's accurate. I checked it out to the second with the news this morning. Are you type A? I am type A plus. In relationship to certain things. Other things, I'm type D. What does that mean? Really bad. Like my room. Mess. I cannot keep my books neat. They got to be all over the place. They got to be all over. And they very commonly end up with bruises falling over my books and hitting my head on the table. And then they're screaming and yelling. And then I have to remember what my anger counselor said about getting angry. But yes, I did go to an anger counselor. And I've even been in a 12-step program for, believe it or not, I know you don't believe this, but I went to one for codependency. I did. Did you know that anger is a sign of codependency? You may not know that, but it is. But we don't have time to talk about that right now. Okay. But I'll tell you what, it really helped me, the 12-step program, big time. And then counseling specifically and how to handle anger, men, big time on anger. Okay. Emotional hurts is the main source of anger. Something in your life that's hurt you that you've never fully grieved out, or maybe ask the forgiven the person for, is the main source of anger. The teeth gritting, the punching things, the wanting to hurt yourself and other people. You know what I'm talking about? You know what I'm talking about? Are you getting us? Control yourself. Okay. All right. That kind of anger is an emotional hurt problem. Mine was my dad beating me hard. That was my big thing. Okay, so let's talk about liver function tests. We did bilirubin already. Now let's talk about these tests that are really going to finish this off just before lunch. It's always a good idea. Okay, and then you can go out and get oysters and get all kinds of hepatitis if you want. What do we use the transaminases for? They are indices of liver cell necrosis. Liver cell necrosis, a la hepatitis. We had AST, which used to be called SGOT, ALT, which used to be called SGPT. Which is more specific? ALT. It's only found in the liver. AST, SGOT, is present in muscle, is present in red blood cells, and is present in liver. Therefore, if you had a viral hepatitis with massive liver cell necrosis, which would be the predominant transaminase elevated? ALT. Example, 2,500 ALT, 2,200 AST. Comprende? That means, do you comprehend that concept? So that's the main enzyme going to be elevated in any kind of diffuse liver cell necrosis. All right, now, an alcoholic hepatitis, that is not what happens. And there's a reason. AST is present in the mitochondria of hepatocytes. ALT is not. It's in the cytosol. And because alcohol, as I told you in the very first lecture, is a mitochondrial poison. Remember, uncouples, remember? And AST is predominantly in there. When you have alcoholic hepatitis, AST is higher than ALT. Forget the 2-to-1 ratio crap. If you see AST higher than ALT, it's alcoholic liver disease. Could be fatty change, could be alcoholic hepatitis, could be cirrhosis. Is it useful? Big time. Big time important. Big time important. If it's viral hepatitis, ALT will be higher than AST. Very simple. All right, now, what are the enzymes of obstruction? Obstruction of what? Bile ducts. Answer, alkaline phosphatase and gamma-glutamyl transferase. We use gamma-glutamyl transferase here. I know that in some of your countries use 5-nucleotidase. It's a very good test. We don't use it a whole lot, but you could throw that in here because it's a marker of obstruction. But you won't see it on the test because you don't use it that much. We use gamma-glutamyl transferase and alkaline phosphatase. So anytime you have obstruction to bile ducts, those would be the two enzymes predominantly elevated. Now, transaminases will be up a little bit, but not to the same degree as the alkaline phosphatase and gamma-glutamyl transferase. You with me so far? I told you a while back that gamma-glutamyl transferase was located in a certain organelle in a cell. What was that organelle, please? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And I told you that when the smooth endoplasmic reticulum was revved up, underwent hyperplasia due to drugs like alcohol, barbiturates, rifampin, phenytoin, that you not only increase the metabolism of the drug that was being given, but we also cause the increased synthesis of gamma-glutamyl transferase. So I'm going to ask you a question. What would be the classic thing that you would see in any alcoholic liver disease? AST, higher than ALT, and what else are you going to see? An increase in gamma-glutamyl transferase. Guys, it doesn't get any easier. It doesn't get any easier. It is incredibly, incredibly simple. Now, there's a problem. The problem is that alkaline phosphatase is in other things other than the liver. It's in bone with osteoplastic activity. It's in placenta. It's in a lot of other things. So how are you going to know where alkaline phosphatase comes from? How do you know whether it's due to bile duct obstruction versus some other things? Simple! Gamma-glutamyl transferase is only located in the liver. So if alkphos is elevated and gamma-glutamyl transferase is normal, guys, alkphos is not of liver origin. It's somewhere else. If it is elevated along with it, guys, that means then that it is bile duct obstruction. Is this simple or what? It's very, very, very simple. Guys, this is what hepatologists do when they get consults on working up jaundice. Good grief, you don't have to consult the hepatologist to work up jaundice. You could pretty much pinpoint it down to the exact diagnosis without getting a consult. You can just basically say, this is what's causing it. I think they need an ERCP. And they'll look at you. How do you know? All right, there you go. All right, we already went through the fractionation of total bilirubin and how we can use that in defining different diseases. Okay? Albumin protein. These are markers of severity of liver damage. Albumin is made in the liver. Therefore, if you had severe liver disease, a la cirrhosis, then albumin should be decreased. You already knew that. But even better than that is a prothrombin time, because the majority, not all, von Willebrand's factor isn't made in the liver, but most coagulation factors are made there. And so if you had severe liver damage, you would not be making that, and the prothrombin time would be prolonged. Agreed? Agreed? So those are your two best tests for liver severity, with prothrombin time being a little bit better than albumin. In fact, for part two, you know, about Child's criteria, where you have to, you know, check someone out before you're going to do a systemic shunt on them, you know, for ascites and stuff like that, they apply this Child's criteria to see what your prognosis is going to be. Albumin is one of the factors that determines, you know, the prognosis in doing a portal systemic shunt of some kind. There's only one autoantibody that's important, and that's anti-mitochondrial antibodies in primary biliary cirrhosis. Okay, we'll talk about that this afternoon. Okay, and then, of course, tumor markers, alpha fetoproteins, a marker for hepatocellular carcinoma. Also, some people use alpha-1 antitrypsin since it's made in the liver. It'll be increased in hepatocellular carcinoma, these different markers. Guys, I think what you should be thinking about now is that if you have this fractionation of bilirubin that you can do, less than 20%, 20 to 50%, greater than 50%, you already started off your differential diagnosis and what the thing was, right? Then you throw on top of it these enzymes, primarily transaminases. Can you see how that's going to correlate with viral hepatitis with a conjugated bilirubin between 20 and 50%? Or obstructive liver disease, alpha-phosphatase gamma glutamyl transferase will be elevated, right? Conjugated bilirubin percent greater than 50%. Are you with me? You can see how this is all coming together and how it's going to be so easy for you to answer all the questions correctly that deal with liver disease on part one, part two, and part three. This is not just for part one. You can use this stuff all for part two as well and part three. No problem. So when we come back, that's if you come back, or want to come back, I know you will, we'll finish this off.